heartily welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this panel discussion at the University of Vienna about the most needed social innovations of the 21st century. I would like to welcome you on behalf of the rector of the University of Vienna. I myself am dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences and was very glad if then Josef Hochgerner contacted me to somehow host this panel discussion at our university and at our faculty. You see, the Faculty of Social Sciences is very familiar, I would say, with innovations, as we have to be innovative each day and each hour, I would say so. We are a faculty with 18,000 students. If we would be a standalone university, we would be the third to fourth largest university in Austria. We have a student-professor ratio, which I don't tell you, but which makes the professors very have the need to be innovative as well as for the personal survival within this organization and as well as the survival of the social sciences. So the issue is very near to us in practice and also, of course, in theory. We have a wonderful composition of the panel today, and I think it somehow mirrors the movement and the differences we experience in the last 30 to 40 years in Europe concerning the reorganization of sciences and universities. We have representatives from universities. We have representatives from research institutions, very large ones and very long-standing ones outside the universities, dealing with a lot of applied research. We have representatives of people who are doing research on their own. We have representatives who are people of managing research and organizing research. And it becomes more and more a task, science more and more an enterprise that a scientist perhaps 30 or 40 years wouldn't have thought of. Thus, representing the different organizational forms, we have represented also different procedures which will focus more on perhaps basic research, but most of them on technocratic and applicable results. More and more, this composition, I think, mirrors the fact that traditional research organizations fall and the borders between universities as such and other research organizations break down and get open, institutionally as well as personally. Personally, you have the experience of Professor Josef Hochgerner and myself. We both have studied at this university together sociology. He made his career in a big research institute outside the university. I stayed in the university area, and I think this personal contact helps also in cooperating, and I hope that we will cooperate even more intensively in the future, especially as it's the case that Professor Hochgerner got his professorship also from the University of Vienna and the Faculty of Social Sciences and is teaching with us. Universities, as I said, is not an ivory tower, and university organization itself is somehow innovative, and somehow staying here in Vienna at this university, at the representative of social sciences from the University of Vienna, I somehow doubt if we were an ivory tower before or ever. I might remind you, it's 70 years in the past now already, or 80 years in the past, of the famous study of a village in unemployment of Marienthal, village performed by Paul Lazarsfeld, Marie Yahuda, and Paul Zeisel, who was done out of this university. And if you read the foreword of this study, I think it's still the most selling study in social sciences as far as the book selling is concerned. If you read the foreword, the researchers were university assistants and went to the political party and said, we want to make some kind of interesting psychological, sociological study about some general issue. And the politician sitting there said, well, we are in an area of tremendous unemployment in the 30s. We have really social problems. Why don't you research this? And the outcome was not just an applicable study. I think the outcome was a very innovative and creative methodology, inspiring research, science, as well as contributing to the praxis. And social sciences, I think, understood itself, and we understand ourselves at the university, always in this kind of poles between that what we as professors have to do, have scientific impact, but also for social sciences, social impact. And thinking of a crisis in the early 20th century, I think we are now everybody's talking about economical, political, global transformations, and perhaps the look to this creative and innovative studies in the past might also motivate us to have innovative procedures, scientific procedures for the future, for the world in the future, at least for Europe in the future. Therefore, I'm looking forward to the discussions of our precious colleagues on the most on the social innovation for the 21st century. I'm looking forward to it and give my word to Sabine Herrlichka, who will moderate the discussions. I hope you will enjoy.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, welcome to our discussion. My name is Sabine Herrlichka. I'm with the Austrian Research Promotion Agency, and I will moderate this discussion. Before going into the details, I want to summarize a bit of the background briefly. First of all, I think it's important to keep in mind that the global interest in social innovation increased dramatically over the last years, and certainly starting with the year 2000. As a consequence, a number of initiatives and programs have been developed, and also institutions for the development, the research, the promotion, and the dissemination of social innovation have been set up. Most recently, I think it's interesting to stress and point out that at European level, a working group on this issue has been set up, and also in the US, President Obama has implemented an Office of Social Innovation in the White House. We are very lucky in Austria that we have the Center for Social Innovation, CSI, that was established in the year 1990 already. And based on the initiative of CSI, the implementation of a global resource network to stimulate, to analyze, and to promote social innovation worldwide has been put forward. And this discussion today is a first step in this direction. For the podium discussion, I would like to say that we would hope that it's going to be a real discussion. We foresee it for a duration of some 2 hours. Of course, many of the enthusiastic people we have here are available if all of us we want to continue, but basically the plan is to end at 8 o'clock. We are going, as for the program of the discussion, we are planning to start with an opening round, and in principle, each of the guest speakers with the key messages on the most needed social innovations for around 5 to 8 minutes, so that we really have some time for discussion. And after this first round of opening statements, we are opening for the discussion. And with this, I want to introduce our high-caliber speakers of this evening. And as I am briefly presenting the speakers, Joe Hochgerner is giving you some background information by the slides, so you have both dimensions, hearing and seeing. I'm going to start with Joe Hochgerner. He is the founder and currently the scientific director of SETSI, the Center for Social Innovation here in Vienna. SETSI is the oldest and largest organization, largest at least if you think in dimension of staff, currently some 60 people at SETSI, with primary focus on social innovation. The vision is to operate as an autonomous, politically independent scientific institution, asserting leadership in Europe to advance social innovation and foster an open and solidly united society. SETSI bridges knowledge generation and knowledge application processes by research, by education, advisory, and networking services to reduce the gap between social needs and potentials of knowledge-based information society. As for Joe Hochgerner himself, a bit of background information, first vocational training in aeronautical engineering, and then continued with studies on sociology at the universities of Vienna and Freiburg. I'm not going into the details of his various affiliations. He started with the Institute of Applied Sociology, moved on to various institutions, and currently is SETSI. The second guest speaker I want to introduce is Maria Carmen Lemos from the University of Michigan and the Department of Natural Resources and Environment. Her background is a bachelor in economics and a master and PhD in political sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, with her fields of study in environmental policy and planning. Her particular research interests in understanding are the use of techno-scientific information, especially seasonal climate, in building and adaptive capacity to climate variability and change in the US and in Latin America. Furthermore, the impact of technocratic decision-making on issues of democracy and equity, the co-production of science and policy, and the role of technocrats as decision-makers, quite interesting, the role of popular participation in urban environmental policymaking, and US-Mexican border region environmental policymaking, especially regarding transboundary water conflicts, environmental health, and the common use of shared national resources. I want to continue with Brenton Caffin. He is the CEO of the Australian Center for Social Innovation. I had to smile when I saw your keyword or motto, so to say, bold ideas, better lives. The Australian Centre for Social Innovation has been established to identify and promote innovative ideas, approaches, programs, and solutions for tackling the big social, economic, environmental, cultural challenges of the 21st century. Delivering visible change and significant social benefits and contributing to a more inclusive and just society for all Australians. Brenton is Australian. He graduated from the University of London, has worked in public and private sectors in Australia and the UK, and served in the department of the Australian Prime Minister. He took over the CEO position quite recently in October, and the centre is based in South Australia and was launched by the Prime Minister, by the Premier, with a $6 million funding commitment from the South Australian government. Hans-Werner Franz, who is member of the management board of Sozialforschungsstelle Dortmund and founder of Social Innovation Company in Dortmund. This Sozialforschungsstelle, Central Scientific Institute of the University of Technology in Dortmund, is one of the long-established major research centers for social sciences in Germany. Founded in 1946, the SFS has been a state institute of North Rhine-Westphalia from 1972 to 2006. Since the beginning of 2007, SFS is a central scientific institute of the University of Technology in Dortmund. A multidisciplinary team of labor scientists, social scientists, economists, educators, statistical experts, engineers, computer scientists undertake research, consultation, and evaluation projects with respect to current issues in the world of labor. The research puts heavy emphasis on directly applicable results, and a main part of projects are organized in networks of cooperation with partners from respective research or consulting field. His background is a PhD in social sciences. He is a senior researcher and consultant, a graduate translator, interpreter, and journalist. And further on, Louise Pulford from the Young Foundation. Louise is the coordinator and is involved in the secretariat for the Social Innovation in itself, E-Exchange 6, the global network for individuals and organizations involved in social innovation. She is responsible for the day-to-day management of the network and the SIX webpage and the events. A little bit more on SIX. SIX is based at the Young Foundation in London. Louise also shares responsibility for Uprise, a new leadership program that is being developed by the Young Foundation to support and train a new generation of public leaders. Uprising identifies, recruits, develops, and supports 19 to 25-year-olds to enable them to play a greater role in politics and public decision-making. Louise herself graduated from the University of Bristol with a Master in East Asian Studies. As part of her Master's, Louise worked for a British consultancy in Beijing. She's a keen Mandarin speaker. We will still stick to English. and is a member of a leading Sino-British business organization. She's involved in many community activities and is a member of the advisory board of One Young World. And not least, Pierre Valette, representing the European Commission. He studied mathematics and economics, and he is currently within the Directorate Science Economy and Society, the head of unit for prospective planning for research in economic, social, and sciences humanities. And previously, he was acting director for the environmental program also at the European Commission. I know this was a longer introduction, but I think it was valuable information setting the scene for the statements. I would like to give the floor now to Joe Hochgerner. 5 to 8 minutes, I was told. For the key message on the most needed social innovations of the 21st century. Please, Joe.
Okay. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I'm proud of standing here after working for social innovation and now having the opportunity in the middle of a working conference we have organized with colleagues from almost around the world to appear here in the university. The title of this discussion is very ambitious. The most needed social innovations of the 21st century. So we want to think in the long run what will be needed most. We will not be able to say how it has to be done. We will elaborate how to think about it and how to prepare for that. And I gave out one slogan for us all to remain with the feet on the ground while having the head in the sky. So we are reaching for the sky. That also implies, on the other hand, modesty. We have to be modest because we cannot do everything, even if we have the best ideas, because even the best ideas may not solve the problem if people do not accept it. And this is the main core of our short working definition of social innovation, which is presented here. New concepts and measures to resolve societal issues, challenges, in a better way than doing nothing or doing the old way. And it has to be accepted by the groups concerned. Now, of course, I thought a lot myself, what could be the key message? What do I think is most important if we want to have a change as we like it in the 21st century? I came to the conclusion that I would put forward two ideas. One is to dismantle, to get rid of, to overthrow the dominance of the conceptualization of economy as management of scarcity. This is a far-reaching thesis. I stand by saying so on the shoulders of John Kenneth Galbraith, who put forward or published The Affluent Society already in 1958. Now it's 50 years and 1 year. The economy is a basis for our life. But we have a false concept. It descends from the past centuries when scarcity was real, the main problem. The main problem of our economy of today and in the 21st century is that we produce, to make it very short and to stay in the 8 minutes, too much. And we do not know how to proceed with the results of this success. So this is the most important fundamental change, I think, that has to take place. Secondly, to do so, we'll need another way of thinking. Not just different mindsets, but real thinking which separates itself from the tradition of linear thinking. Make an analysis, take the first step, the second step. Every step has to be right and not being wrong. If you do something false, like in programming, you go back and you start from the beginning. This is linear thinking. Lateral thinking or non-linear thinking enables you to leap over some of these stages and to acknowledge that not everything must be right. But you want to reach a certain target and you conclude, if I want to reach this target, I have to do something now and do, of course, then one step after another. So this is a way of thinking that has to be implemented in economic processes, in institutions of learning, of universities, in schools, in any educational field, and in politics, and beyond the boundaries of the nation states, as we are used to think them. Now, this, of course, is the key message, just to underline it a bit, just to give you food for thought, not to elaborate on that. I want to say, if we want to change perceptions, knowledge into action, given the changes provided by globalization, we have some tools. The tools have main methods. They produce results. And in the end, there's the question, what resources for innovations do we have? The tools in the knowledge society, I would say, are all the inherited tools of the industrial society, plus data, information, knowledge, and what is most missing, wisdom. The main method of data is abstraction. The main usage is processing and segregation. You set things apart. But it's a resource of innovation because it produces facts and figures. Information, a little bit higher in the system, produces pattern recognition. It enables us to attribute information to certain situations that may result in conflicts. And there is a resource for innovations deriving from information. Namely, we can do forecasts and scenarios, well-established methods nowadays, or since a few decades. Knowledge is mainly, as we know it, linear thinking, as I mentioned before. The results of linear thinking may be cognition on the one hand, but it may also lead to empathy. Not only understanding, but also trying to co-understand, and what results is strategies and conventions. Next week, Copenhagen, a very good example for that. Huh? This is you making use of knowledge, or trying to make use of knowledge in the form of strategies and conventions. Now, if we would add what I dare to say is wisdom, or might be wisdom, even maybe something, some kind of collective wisdom, it implies lateral thinking, nonlinear thinking. It may result in creation, to create things, in balancing, socially balancing what cannot be done, what cannot be balanced by the economy itself. And as a result, it should end up with joint action, which will be a real theme of this evening. And I'll make it very short. Do we need United States of the world? Is this the joint action? No. What we really need is a united world society beyond the nation states. This is my first input. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Maria. May I ask you?
It's always a challenge to ask the Brazilian to keep time, but I'll try. I'll try. Okay, so climate change, social dimensions of climate change is a huge problem. It's so huge that sometimes we can't wrap our minds around it, which is a problem in itself. The problem that I'm going to speak specifically here is the problem of adaptation. So how will people adapt to climate change? Adaptation is what we call the quintessential wicked problem. Problems become wicked when we don't even know the dimensions of the problem themselves, let alone what can we think in terms of solutions. We know that we all adapt every day. We adapt to climate every day. We carry an umbrella when the weather forecast says that we are going, when it's going to rain or not. However, every time that we don't carry that umbrella, we get wet. So we adapted, but we adapted in a slightly negative way. We didn't die, we're just wet, but we are worse off than they were when we left the house. So adaptation is this kind of problem for the world, especially for the world poor, who don't have an umbrella to carry to start with, and are gonna always get wet. So when we think about problems of adaptation, we have to think about what you expect from a future that we completely don't know yet. So for my money, the best and the most needed adaptation innovation or social innovation in the near future, especially for poor people around the world and for decision makers, is to start thinking about problems that we don't know how they are going to present to us. So how do we think outside the box? How do we start to think about the unthinkable? In the jargon of climate change, you know, the new phrase is stationarity is dead, because as Joseph said before, things in the globe are changing much quicker in a completely nonlinear way. So even things that we predicted 5 years ago in the last IPCC are already obsolete. The IPCC last year is already obsolete. Things are changing in ways that there is no pattern to it. So how do you start to think about answers and about solutions that are undefined at this point, that we don't know how to do? We all based our decisions on experience. If we have never experienced something before, we are very much at a loss. So for my conception and my research is about meeting unknown needs of a future that we don't know yet. Quite daunting, isn't it? So how do we start to think about those things? And how do you reconcile those things with what we know, which are very sluggish politicians, bad bureaucratic systems, lack of money, lack of social inclusion, all the problems that we already know? That's my bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Brenton, may I ask you for your statement?
Good evening. Maria and I didn't actually compare notes before we came here tonight, but funnily enough, we actually have very, very similar takes on the big social innovation that's required today. The good news is, as Maria also pointed out, is we have adapted to climate in the past. We can do it. Social innovation is not a new idea. It may be a bit trendy, and there's lots of new institutions that are cropping up, not least ours, which was set up in Adelaide last month. But societies have adapted to the challenges that face them. What's changed is the scale, the pace, and the complexity of the challenges that we face today. Back in you know, 5000 BC or whenever it was, people migrated towards cities, and that created new opportunities for wealth creation and for social services. Today, you know, the internet didn't exist in its current form 10 years ago. Technological opportunities are creating new ways for us to address social problems. But equally, social problems are now being created at a rate that were never envisaged before. So in that environment where the scale and pace and complexity of change and the challenges facing society is increasing, what do we need? I argue that we actually need the innovation, if you like, is that we need to build societies that are adaptable, that are collaborative, and that are resilient. We need to actually find ways to help a society organise itself and solve problems for itself rather than expecting research institutions or government departments to do it for them. That requires a systemic approach to social innovation. As I say, social innovation has always existed, but what we need to do is to try and find ways and methods for this to happen more frequently, more successfully, and with a bigger and better social impact. So how might you go about building a system of social innovation? Well, interestingly, because I'm setting up a new organisation myself, I've given this a bit of thought. And I'm going to be very, very brief on this, but effectively, we're looking at attacking innovation, if you like, or attacking the social challenges on three levels. Firstly, there's innovation around challenges themselves. So let's identify the key problem areas we want to work on, and let's focus effort on creating new ways, new combinations, new partnerships for addressing those. The next level, there's an opportunity for us to try and find the tools and the methods that actually help find these ways of solving social problems. And a lot of work, and I won't steal too much of Louise's thunder, but a lot of work has gone into this with the Young Foundation, where they've documented about 500 methods. And I think the challenge for us is to actually sort of build our understanding of what works when, and to make sure that that's put out into the ether in a way that people can access that, and they can, as I say, do the social innovating themselves. Which leads me to my third level, which is around learning and engagement. How do we make sure that we capture what's working and we share that and we tap into the collective intelligence of society to solve problems? There have been some great technological advances for anyone who's tried to sell anything on eBay recently in terms of how we as a society sort of come together to sort of solve problems like finding very rare stamps or whatever. We need to actually take some of those learnings and actually apply them to solve social problems. The technology exists, the methods exist. We have the imperative to do something about these challenges because they're not going away. And so social innovation, while it's not new, has a renewed focus because we actually need to sort of address these problems. Mm-hmm. That's my contribution. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Hans-Werner Franz.
My key message is that science in a knowledge-based society has to change its role and has a changed role for and in society. And this role contains a shift from the transfer of knowledge, as the traditional idea of enlightenment puts it, to the organization of co-production of knowledge between science and society. We put that as a process which we call social science production. That means it is the production of social science in a process, in a social process of producing science. And that's a completely different understanding of how to do science as compared to the traditional self-understanding of science. That means science cannot only want to change society for whatever reason, it has to change itself and its own practice. And that means it has to undergo a change process itself and become something like a competence center for certain societal areas, social or societal, both. Becoming something like a competence center or even a change agent for such a social area, maybe for a region like us, for the Ruhr area, means that you cannot stay unchanged. You have to change actively, because if not, you are changed without knowing what change you are undergoing. So if you want to be the master of change, of your own change, you must know where to go. That means you need something like a quality-based profile and strategy. And now that doesn't work. Yeah, now it does. You need something like a vision and a mission, which is not as general as a university's one could be. That means if you want to contribute to... We want to contribute, in our case, our vision is to contribute to the raising of self-reflective capacity of the social field in which we are working. So we are not saying you have to change and you have to change in this or that direction. We just want to help people who are acting in some context to find out how to do it the best way, as they think. And we are participating in this process. And our mission actually is, in our institute, is to accompany industrial change in the Ruhr area, which we have been doing for a long time. When you do that, you have to become something like a vanguard in some fields. You have to be the best. in some way of thinking. Because if not, you will not be accepted. So that is an aim in itself for your scientific institute. And that means you must become wide open for the requirements, changing requirements and developments in society, instead of wanting to transport, to convey only what you think is correct. That means you work in projects, you work in projects with other people pay, taxpayers, for example, ministries, European Commission, municipalities, and so on, maybe also companies. And that means that you have to become market and customer oriented, which seems to contradict completely the old self vision of universities. And it does conflict, of course, because you have to find a balance between autonomy, which you must stick to in order to stay independent of your customers, and at the same time try to be committed to find good results for your customers. So that's a difficult situation which has to be managed. And managing such situations actually is one of the new ways of doing research. Co-production of social science is a process in which very different actors of very different interests and fields and languages and disciplines have to work together, and you become the manager of this process, which means you have to become a different person. You cannot act as the traditional scientist. The traditional scientists ask only for analysis. Now you have to ask of how to do it the best way. That's a management question. That's not a scientific question alone. And that also means when you work on projects, which is defined money, defined time, and defined objectives, it also means that you have to economize your work. You cannot stay as long as you want with one topic. You have to come to results. So you don't, because you don't have more money and time. You're not paid for more. And you also must become able to network with all these different partners. We have tried to translate this necessity into the organization of our institute, which inside is a networking organization. And we consider ourselves as a network organization, which is networking in a network of networks, basically. So we try to be as connected as possible to society, and we try to have that in our own organization. So that's the way of being customer focused without being dependent of the customer. And all that means, in one word, a research organization, maybe even a teaching organization, has to become very receptive to the needs and necessities of its surrounding society and social field. That means it has to become a learning organization, because without being open to learn from your practice together with others, you will not be able to manage that sort of change. So social science production means you have to be able to change not only your surroundings, your environment, but also yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Talking about networks, Luis, please. That's it.
Excellent. Thanks very much. Thank you, Joseph, for inviting us here today. I think Joe said at the beginning that it was quite an ambitious question. I'd like to say it's actually quite a mean question. To think of just one social innovation that the most needed for the 21st century is incredibly difficult. And if we think about social innovation, it's essentially a new way of dealing with the same, with new challenges. And when we've got challenges like climate change and economic downturns and lack of access to services and an ageing population, to think of one social innovation, I think, is quite difficult. So I took the question and decided to pull it back a bit and think about the work that we do with SIX, with the Social Innovation Exchange around the world. I think a good thing, part of the challenge, is that we all seem to agree quite a lot, so hopefully it won't be too dull a discussion at the end. But I mean, essentially, I've just simplified what everyone else has said on this panel today, and that is that we think the most important social innovation of the next century is to be able to talk. I'm going to break it down. With an increased interest in, there is an increased interest in social innovation. It is said to be quite trendy these days. But the amount of people that are involved in the amount of people that are involved in social innovation is still quite small. And there is very little understanding about the field. And there are very little people out there just doing social innovations. So the first step to my solution is to talk. We need to share ideas. There needs to be more networks for collaboration, or better networks for collaboration. There needs to be expansion of things like the Social Innovation Exchange. We need to stop reinventing the wheel. And if we are just trying to find a better way to deal with the same challenges and new challenges, then we need to have a better ability of knowing what's going on out there. There's no point me sitting in London trying to set up a leadership programme for young people if a guy in Korea has just set the same thing up essentially and has for the last 5 years gone through all the learning that I need to do now. So we need to better know what's going on out there, and we need to better be able to trust each other so we can act. So we need to act. We need to do it. I need to go and set something up. I need to go and ask my colleagues in France and Germany and Australia to go and set the same thing up as me. And we need to know there's a safe space that we can do that, because then we can pull it back again and we can learn from each other. And I think what is important for the world of social innovation is that we act now. And there is no point acting unless we can learn from each other. So we need some rapid learning. We need to develop new skills. And we need to develop a shared base of what we've learned, our successes, our failures. And we need to be okay to go out there and fail. And once we've learned from each other, we can develop more of a knowledge base about social innovation, which will enable other people to go out there and do the same thing that we've done. And Brenton quickly mentioned earlier on this work on the methods for social innovation. Methods is probably a bit too techie a language and it doesn't really mean anything. So we translate this as ways of doing. And we've looked at the innovation cycle from the inception of an idea to the starting, to going out and doing something, the acting, then to the learning, then to how you scale up the project, how you disseminate it, how you affect more people with it, and how eventually you create systemic change. And we've looked at the innovation process along the whole of this. We like to call it a spiral because we wouldn't like to do any linear thinking. But we've looked at the innovation process on this spiral and looked at the methods from all around the world that have been used to do this, from things like new finance models and participatory budgeting, to how to engage citizens more, to how you grow your social innovation, how you set up the same thing that we're doing in the UK and Australia, to how you actually create the systemic change in society. And all of these methods and ways of doing will be collected together on a very quick plug, socialinnovator.org, which will be released in the new year for people to go on and comment and come back and say, no, I've done it a much better way, and we don't agree with what you're doing here at all. But it's only when we can create this knowledge base by talking to each other that we can really advance social innovation. So that would be my contribution for the most needed social innovation of the 21st century, to talk.
Thanks a lot. Let's continue to talk. Pierre Valette, the concluding key message before we open the discussion, please.
Thank you. In general, the last one has nothing to say again. No. But I have things to say. And yes, because my role is perhaps to show you that European Union is doing something. I don't know if from Austria you think that in Brussels we take care of social innovation. I am not sure, but we do. but we do. And I will try to demonstrate this now. But, you know, we have always to say the motivation. Why we like social innovation? And I insist on this first motivation. I have myself, but I think a lot of you have also, the global crisis. The global crisis will have far-reaching social consequences in terms of unemployment. It's already like this. And this it will make the challenge more pressing. All the challenges I say now, aging population, globalization, education and skills, technological change, poverty, my God, urbanization, gender roles, are generating needs of social innovation, and I would say these needs will increase with crisis, will be more urgent. It means it's urgent, even urgent. So social innovation has to be fully recognized and supported. I have to say that a major policy initiative of member states, European Union and third countries, Australia, Canada, US, BRICS, developing countries, they have, all these countries have to do something, and they start to be something very significant. And it's not only the public sector, it's also the matter of private sectors. So that means entrepreneurship are involved in this. What is the social innovation about? So that means perhaps we have to say. Because, you know, in Brussels, I will show you that we have some concern with definitions. I spoke with my colleagues this afternoon. For them, it was obvious, it was simple. Nevertheless, when we see the text and the new documents of the Commission and some member states, they don't speak explicitly of social innovation. Why? Because it's not clear. It's not clear. But I think everybody thinks it is clear. This is clearly to improve the human being and social needs. This is a response to social demands. This is a process also of social interaction between the individuals. You know this wording of social economy after the crisis. We speak more and more social economy. We speak of the third sector, system based on solidarity, inclusion, reciprocity, exclusion. All this wording is becoming, I would say, a day by day wording. So that means we live with this. And the enterprise with social objective and more participative processes, they say that they are doing now this corporate responsible. Corporate social responsibility. I don't know if they do, but they say they want to do, at least. So why perhaps we don't speak so much of social innovation? Because we don't know exactly the value of social innovation. You know, when we speak of solidarity, when we speak of exclusion, when we speak of these values, it's difficult to compare with other values, which are more simple to measure, like economic values. So that means perhaps for these reasons, it's difficult to speak of this. We don't forget that it is not an issue at local level, not an issue. It's not an initiative at local level. It can be very special, long-term. All these dimensions have to be taken into account. So to show you now that the European policy is taking care of social innovation, I encourage you to go to the website of the Commission, European Commission, where you can read the new policy, which is the post-Lisbon strategy. Many people say that the Lisbon strategy was not so much social innovation oriented. I don't want to judge, but the new one is. And you are consulted. That means you have access to the website of the Commission to give your opinion about the new strategy, which is taking place now in 2010 for the 10 next years. So I encourage you to have access. You have until the 15th of January. You have even the holidays at the end of the year to work on this. And you can be sure that people will read this. And you can speak of social innovation, because you will see that this word is not used in the document, even if all the components is in. All the components are in the text, but the word social innovation is not in. Again, some concern about this expression. It's like sustainable development, you know. Everybody is in favor of sustainable development. Also, this expression is not in the text, even if many components are relevant for sustainable development. You know, this question of wording, of jargon, is not jargon, wording is important. Well, we have the Renew Social Agenda for 2020. It's too late now to react on the Renew Social Agenda because it has been adopted 1 year ago. We have the European Innovation Act, which speaks for the first time not only of technology innovation but also of social innovation. Is also too late to react because it was adopted 1 month ago. And you have the European research area where I come from. And we start to speak of social innovation because for the first time, European research area framework program, our program on social science and humanities, say that research has to be driven by societal challenge. So automatically, and this is new, don't think this is the whole story, it's new. Societal challenge are the drivers for research now in Europe. Which means that, of course, social innovation is in, automatically. So last but not least, even the most important, it is the financial perspective which should be adopted to for the period 2013 to 2020. So I mean in 3 years, the budget for the different European Union programs will be adopted. And here, you know, this is a good moment to prepare this because here the budget are coming to support initiatives. So this is really all these things, the challenge in front of us. Green economy, role of public sector to push social innovation, welfare system for urban issues, something which has been decided in your country for the EU program in your town, in your city. You know, it was decided in Vienna that welfare system for urban issues, that means social innovation for cities, will be taken on board. It is now. It is open. Demand-side research-oriented, beyond GDP, how to go beyond the economic value of our economies, taking into account well-being and environment. All these things are grips which are in the research on social innovation and in SSH program. We have invented also a new instrument for which even your city is very attached because every big decision has been taken in this city for social platform. The social platform is how to define a research agenda, not only between the scientists, it's always dangerous, but with the scientists and the users of research results. And the decision makers. And we had it on urban issues and cohesion, and we decided something. We had another one which has been decided, I understood, by the researchers and some civil society organization. It is on family. And the next one is, you know, the title is Innovation Social Services. It's specifically dedicated for social innovation. You will see in these things, social platform has something very important. They think also in terms of vision of the future. That means that, and we did it, the world in 2025 that you can access also on our website. And if I speak like this of social innovation, this is because this exercise of world 2025, having a vision of long-term future, it was obvious that we have to go now and to ensure that we are going well to a transition which is called socio-ecologic transition. And socio-ecologic transitions oblige us to take care of social innovation. And this is why the research program is so oriented now on social innovation. So I was today in Vienna. You know, we have Australian, we have American, we have German, British, Austrian colleagues who were together to discuss. They stay. My colleague Martina Hartl stay with us from the Commission, stay with us tomorrow, and they will try to see how to build something, to cooperate, to apply for research, in particular for EU research. I am sure they will be successful. They have to do it. And they have to take the opportunity of the European program. You know, this is the only research program which is open to the world. So a good moment to do something. So in addition, this is a European program. That means this is your program. So don't hesitate to apply. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much to all of you here for your opening statements. Now it's up to you. You have a lot of issues on the menu, so to speak. And we wanted to have this meeting today as a real discussion, as a real opportunity for discussion. So I open the floor for comments and questions. Please.
I have two small comments. My first comment is regarded to social innovation. And Mr. Wallet gave us an impression what could be meant with this. In comparison, Mr. Caffin just told us social innovation is important. But it used, for me, it sounded like an empty phrase. And I was almost annoyed to hear it, you know. Because if you don't say anything else besides social innovation, you have to give some contents. Okay. Number two, my second point is concerning the arguments of Mr. Hochgerner. And if I understand it correctly, he was mainly concentrating on a saying of Mr. Galbraith. It meant like we have to concentrate on the affluent society instead of, let's say, the management of society, of scarcity. And you would like to exchange it. I mean, I am completely in line with you, but I would think, I'm no expert on Galbraith, but if I remember it correctly, he was concentrating on the U.S. And in this case, it was correct to speak about, let's say, affluence. And we need, but what we have to do now is to think about the world. And there's just a few societies, or just, let's say, 1 billion of people are living in affluency, and all the rest is living, not having enough to survive sometimes. So that's number one. And number two, I think it can't be the strategy for the world. And number two, even if you speak about some of our countries, like, let's say, Great Britain or Australia or Austria, you would have to think about one thing. And I'm an economist, and for this reason, I thought it's a small area. If you just stop innovating, if you just stop on concentrating on the way how we do business now, that means you are losing relative wealth. You are losing relative living standards. And so it's very difficult for us to change the world in a more, let's say, equitable. We have to distribute. How do we distribute? And I think that's the main question in this context. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot. Would you like to comment right away?
I might just throw in a quick definition. The reason I didn't give a definition is because there were six of us on the stage, and I figured you might get six definitions, but I can give you one. I mean, from my perspective, social innovation is about new ways to address unmet social needs. So long as there are social needs that are not being met by the status quo, there is an opportunity for innovation to find new ways to address those. And that's why I believe it's a necessity. And if anything, the imperative for social innovation is growing, because the scale of change is creating new unmet social needs, whether it be adaptation to climate change, as an example. The institutions that we've built to address needs, the markets that we rely on to service our needs, have failures. And particularly if you're talking about social services, whether it's the third sector or the government sector, they are institutionally incapable of experimentation, innovation, and reinvention at the pace that we need in today's society. I don't know if that helps.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Pierre.
Yes, I fully agree with this definition, but sometimes concrete sectors where what is said by my colleague is obvious can be said, you know, The new services which correspond to the aging population is something which will create new activities, which is not, I would say, obvious to create from a purely market point of view. You have all these things according health, the services of health, which the health system, everybody knows that they are not enough now and not sustainable from an economic point of view. Education and skills. Okay, also we see some example image transparencies that did not have time to present. But if you speak of knowledge society, as Hans has mentioned, and if you want that to solve this question of unemployment, you have to be sure that this notion of schools, so even second school chains, but also lifelong learning, all these things are social innovation, and they, at the end, they are concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Maria.
Just quickly. So, you know, you ended your comment to say that the real thing is about redistribution. We know that redistribution is very hard to do. So a very concrete way into which social innovation plays a role is that it's not only redistribution of wealth. In relation to climate change, for instance, it's very clear that when you adapt to climate change, you adapt both to the nature, the dimension of the impact, but also to all the other things that are coming your way and making your life change. This sometimes has a very... poverty is a good predictor of vulnerability, but it's not the only one. So one way that social innovation helps us to think about redistribution is how do we actually factor those things, that it's not just about wealth or option for this country, option for that country, but what are fair and right ways of doing it so that across the board you are actually decreasing, improving adaptive capacity across the board. So I think that the role of, at least I'm not a researcher on social innovation, I'm looking for answers like everybody else, but you know, from my perspective, what we need to be smart about is how to even frame those problems on the right way. Somebody told me today during the meeting that we had this afternoon that social innovation is about asking the right questions. And I think that how to get to that is the part that we all have to think together. Maybe we have to talk.
Okay, Joe.
Thank you for challenging the affluent society thesis I put forward. I would like to start with mentioning another economist with Austrian heritage, Karl Polanyi, born in Budapest, grown up in Vienna, exiled to the U.S., who wrote the book entitled The Great Transformation during the Second World War. It was published in 1944, the first time. He elaborates the history of social development, economic development. I could also refer to Fernand Braudel, another highly respected scholar from history. They all show that the Great Transformation, as Polanyi put it, was about to establish the predominance of economic thinking and ruling in our societies. Inasmuch as it is said nowadays, any time and at any Sunday speeches, at negotiations, collective bargaining, etc., or if it comes to the question of living standards and can we afford the living standard we have, the bottom line of all these discussions is it's the economy stupid, you cannot do other. There is no alternative, as Margaret Thatcher put it, the famous Tina, there is no alternative statement. Yeah? And this is what I'm challenging. And I think that Galbraith was right to identify as the first economist in the 50s for the US, totally right, that there is an affluent society with mass production. And this, we have a lot of research about this, and we know about the spread of this affluency, not throughout the world, unfortunately. But again, This has been argued by Galbraith already, that he said capitalism is about to produce private wealth and public poverty. And if we consider this right, and we have lots of evidence for that, the question arises, how can we change this to a governance system in the economy, in politics, and worldwide, so that not only the narrow ruling of economic principles is the bottom line. If we want to change this, we have to introduce social categories, social rules, to balance what the economy does. And for example, we have a big discussion and still ongoing crisis stemming from the financial markets. And the principle of financial markets is to produce wealth, not asking for whom. It's departing, all these derivatives depart from any social need. And it's the shareholder value that rules here. And nowadays we have a lot of talk about stakeholders. But this is only for the nice part of the story. We talk about stakeholders, stakeholder involvement. But if stakeholder society would be really integrated in what the financial markets do, we would have a different ruling. So this is the perspective I would like to point to, not having the full answer.
Thanks a lot. I have a comment here and then followed here. Yes, please.
Hello? Yeah. I'm not working in research, I'm working in acting. I'm running small social projects, and first, I don't understand anything what you said here. Second, I felt a very deep contradiction between Mr. Franz and Joe Hochgerner and all the others, because Mr. Franz spoke about business. He spoke about how research institutes, how universities can work if they want to share with the people doing some acting. Yeah? So I understand what you mean, but I think it's a very big risk. Yeah? Because what we are doing here, my small projects, we have to say today what we will think in 2 days. Because we have our benchmarks, we have to write it down. How much money we will spend on toilet paper, it's really in toilet paper, in 2 years. Yeah? And we are so busy with fundraising. First fundraising, then administration of money. Then this documentation, what happened to the toilet paper. It's fact, yeah? And then after 2 years, we have some data and no wisdom, because nobody's interested in the quality we did. The money giver, there are more, they are interested how many contacts, how many hours, how much, and this and that. So I think what we feel is what Mr. Franz was thinking. And what I mean is that it has to be possible to have an idea and not to be so sure what is on the end. There has to be the possibility of changing work in progress, yeah? Like in arts. I cannot say, and we get money from European Union, and I understand that the European Union wants to know what will happen to the money in 2 years. But with this thinking, this is a contradiction to what everybody else said, Joel said, and also a colleague from USA said, yeah? Or British woman said, yeah? Excuse me, I didn't remember the name. So what we need is more field, and less benchmark.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that opens a huge issue for discussion. But I would also ask you for your comment first and then get back to the podium.
Thank you. I represent the sector of service providers in the field of disabilities. And coming back to what you said and what Mr. Hochgrenner answered, I want to say the sector of social economy in Europe is a big sector. It's about 17% of GDP is produced in the sector of social economy. But this sector does not have an economic theory in the back. So this sector at the moment needs your input. We need coherent theory, and I think the theory should be like you, Mr. Hochgrenner, said it. It is not a theory about shareholders, it's about stakeholders. And what does that mean? How can we argue in a field of economy which is driven by shareholder value? Concrete, if I want to build a building or rent an office, I have to go to the bank and have to show that I bring money back if I want to have money from them. So this is the first area of my question. I think we need your input. We need a coherent economic theory for our work we are doing. The second I want to say, my organization is a member of the social platform in EU. I'm looking very much forward to what you were telling us with the new period up to 2020. Up to now, we produced a lot of social innovation the last years. Our organizations in cooperation with the universities and with research centers. We produced the innovation in the field of EQUAL, for example, a budget line of the European Union. We produce a lot of innovation in the lifelong learning programs and so on. But if I go to, as an Austrian entrepreneur in the field of social economy, if I go to our innovation funds, to our national innovation funds, they tell me, no, you are not the right entrepreneur for us, go to the social ministry. They will give you money, but they don't. So the question is, and I think that's the question all over the world, how can we change that? We produce innovation, and you have stories enough, I have stories enough. We produce social innovation, and this innovation is valid for society. But how can we change that? That our national authorities think that innovation is only technological innovation in the field of ICT or something like that.
So how to drive innovation beyond technology, so to say. All right, going back to the podium, who wants to get started? Yes, Brenton.
I'll be very quick. Just the Australian example on this point about it, social innovation funds or innovation funds for the social sector. We've recently had a review done by our Productivity Commission on the not-for-profit sector, so the third sector, and that recognised the role that they played in social innovation in finding these new ways of dealing with unmet needs, and recommended that new social innovation funds be established and that the existing innovation funds that are generally more attached to research and business innovation be expanded so that the projects you're talking about would get a look in. So I think that's quite important. I just wanted to touch on the earlier question about getting out and doing it, because I think Louise talked a little bit about that, and that's certainly very much kind of what we're hoping to help support as well in Australia. I think it's right to get out and start doing it, and you know, certainly the projects we support, we try not to tie up people in red tape about how much toilet paper they're going to buy in 2 years' time. The only point I would make is I think it's really important to have some hypothesis, some sense of what change that you think you're going to make by doing your project, and then asking yourself after you've done that, after you've done the project, have I made that difference? Have I made more of a difference or less of a difference? Because unless you act and then learn, then you're just doing and you're not sort of improving, but you may be doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, please.
Sorry, can I just add to Brenton's, which is more of a response to both of you, actually, in terms of the development of innovation funds. SIX has an Australian partner, ASIX, and I think the work they're doing in promoting social innovation in Australia and going out there and showing good examples of how new projects that have gone out there and done that have either come back and learned from themselves and done it better the next time and really solved and really, you know, made a difference, cut unemployment or got more people on welfare or helped citizens engage with their state better. All of those things, by going out there and doing that or coming back and learning again and going out and trying again, is the kind of work that ASIX and SIX promote. And I think the report from the Productivity Commission in Australia was very much influenced by the kind of work that ASIX does. And I think remembering that we're very, very early stages in terms of the development of social innovation and the proving of it. You know, we need to prove that it's a good and effective way to deal with problems. And once we start doing that and once we can start having discussions with governments, Obama's office is obviously very important. SIX is about to do a piece of work for the European Commission. And one of the things that we recognise is a big barrier to innovation is having that funds there and having that space to be able to go out there and try something, having the finance to prove yourself before you can go elsewhere and get it, I think is really important. So, I mean, it's a bit of a rubbish answer in a way, but I do believe that putting pressure on is the only way, improving ourselves is the only way that governments will, one, support it, and two, therefore, support the creation of both innovation funds and centres like Brenton's in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Pierre?
Yes, economic consideration. Also an answer to the previous request. Yes, there is a lack of economic theory behind social innovation, behind sustainable development, and this is because they are not so well, you know, implemented, and they are just, yes. But nevertheless, there is an economic theory, which is the economic theory of public goods, which means that if you take into account the so-called externalities, that means the social aspect, environmental aspects, and if your reasoning and your calculation is based, taking into account these elements, the choice or the priorities can change. So the issue is that, does this economy have a chance to be implemented? And there, you know, you can be sure that in Lisbon it was not mentioned. In the new EU 2020 policy, it is mentioned, with this question of beyond GDP. Beyond GDP is exactly how to integrate in the decision-making choice of investment, these notions. So patience a little, perhaps, but it will come. But you know, when you say there is a lack of economy, it's not so so safe. Now, yes, you say when you come in this country, you have been funded, but they don't recognize that you are doing social innovation, and they say this technical innovation that we are. You know, we have still this problem in the choice for European research area, and you know this very well. The fact that now you have the drivers which are changing because they are societal challenge, perhaps it changed something. But my conviction now, because you asked, my feeling is that social needs are strongly increasing with the crisis now. And you see, you know, there is obvious needs to answer to these social needs, more and more. If in the US, Obama has created this new office for social innovation, if Lisbon has completely changed the orientation with EU 2020, is moments which are signals for the future. So that means I am not so negative and go on to do what you do. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Hans Werner.
Well, it is true that we are living in affluent times. So at least we here in Europe, large parts of North America, and growing parts of Southeast Asia. It's difficult in other parts, maybe Arabia, but okay, we'll see. It's not so important to be very precise in that. But I think it is also true that the times of affluence are dwindling away. We are losing time at the moment because we know that the conditions under which we have been coming to affluence are no longer existing in the same way as they were when we started that race. So there are two notions which define politics. One is from Mr. Popper, if I'm not wrong, which is making possible the possible. That's the definition of politics in affluent times. But there is another one which has been coined by Mr. Lenin, which says politics is making possible the necessary. And I think we are much closer to that stage where we need the second phrase and definition of politics, because we are coming to the limits of our growth, which are the basis of affluency, and I think we are coming to the limits of exploiting our planet. And the coming years will be coined and deeply marked by a large effort of respecting these limits, just to put it negatively. And that means I do not really know how to put it positively. Of course, there are a lot of policies in place, and these policies all define clear aims, or more or less clear aims, carbon-free society and that sort of things, which are all clearly necessary, but we need to know how to do that. And it's fairly clear that all these wonderful new aims cannot be achieved without social ways of adapting our societal structures and attitudes and behaviors to the new conditions. We will all have to learn, and that means that innovation policies which only look at technologies, which is absolutely necessary, of course, and becomes even more necessary, are jumping too short if they do not also look at the social ways of tackling with technological change, of coping with all these changes which are wanted from us, from all these citizens and all our social structures. And I think it's important to have not only ideas, which is very important, of course, but also to know at least something about how to implement them, how to make them possible, and what to do. And I think if those who give money for projects ask us to give at least a hint of a structured way how to make possible what we want to do, they do well. Because without being able to prove that I have at least a structured idea of how to do what I'm going for to do, I think it would be not very responsible to provide money.
I'd like to thank you very much for this concerned statement of limitations, because of course I'm not, my head is not so far in the air not to know that there are these limitations, but still I would not refrain from my perspective I tried to outline here, because it's even more so necessary. We need to, we are either going over the top or we are going to make a turnaround. And to make the turnaround will be crucial, and it will be the necessary challenge, the big challenge of the 21st century. And of course the affluency we have now is the result of this very effective usage, I'm looking for the term, the use of industrial materials, resources. But this use has gone much too far. Everybody knows this today. And we have this end of resources day every year, and we have the knowledge, and people have some intentions, and opinions are changing. But how to really make these opinions and the knowledge become effective? And do we need a big catastrophe to learn, or can we learn to avoid the catastrophe? And Karl Polanyi, I mentioned before, wrote about globalization of the 19th century. Where did this globalization go to? It went to the First World War. And I do not hope that this period of globalization we are in will end in the Third World War. So it is dramatic, but there is hope, and we have to do something, as has been said many times here now. And of course we cannot do everything, and it's not speaking the truth, and then it comes valid and viable. It is to start the right way, and everybody, this is one of my standards, has to dig where he or she stands. And since we are in science and we are in innovation, we try it this way. And just to close this with some short remarks on what has been said. First of all, I think innovation does include or should include social innovation. I do not separate social innovation from innovation. Innovation is the big issue, and it has to be filled with the appropriate notions of social innovation, social competence, and social responsibility. And how to change the national innovation policies? Well, dig where you stand. This is part of it, and we will not stop here. This is not a satisfying answer, but it's helping us doing the next step. Then the other issue raised by Liesl Frankl back there about the toilet paper as a significant issue. This ties in with my second big issue I mentioned in the opening statement, linear thinking, and not allowing any way else, any way other. This is what I call the objectivation trap. Since centuries, we try to objectivate everything. And since we got the means not only of natural resources and energy until now, but also information technology, we can objectivate much more than before. And this is the result of linear thinking, of trying to make sure of everything. If you go out, you can assure yourself everything. You can assure your little finger, you get insurance for that, for that, for that. Yeah? And this is not allowing anything beyond the beaten track. And this is why I insisted really working on mental, not mental illnesses, or the sense of people trying to be very sensitive and cognitively very exact is necessary to leave this objectivation trap. Third issue, well, the social economy, this is a real hard work for the future. I agree fully, we have to collaborate here. And this is also a starting point for that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I have Maria and Luis.
Okay, so off. Okay. So I think that there is a lot of convergence about all the things that we've heard here. And, we started a lot of this discussion, and I had discussed this with Brenton a little bit, thinking about, what is the meaning of becoming more resilient, in a positive resilience. So the definition of a resilient system is one that keeps the things it wants to, the properties, the good properties, one that learns and one that self-organizes. All those things are resonating with a lot of the things that have been said here. You know, it's about systemic change that is more than the little parts become bigger because all those properties are working with each other in an adaptive way and responding to positive and negative stimuli or disturbances and raising to a better state than it was before. It's what it's nonlinear thinking. It's all those things together. They are, though, very hard to implement, as Franz has mentioned. Mr. Franz has mentioned before. And one way to think about this is to think about the system as a new paradigm of understanding where we want to get. I wanted to end this on a positive note rather than in a negative note. I think that what the work that all of us do is about understanding the antecedents of doom. So you don't want to get to doom. So you have to understand what's getting you in that position, either overconsumption of natural resources, only thinking about material, not spiritual being and livelihoods and things like that. Once we know where we want to go, it gets easier for us either to accelerate the positive things and to slow down the negative ones. And we can do that. I'm totally convinced that you can do that because the whole idea of understanding the system as a whole rather than small parts is try to purposefully guide it in that direction. And that's a positive thing about social innovation. It's not about doing for doing, but actually being able to guide the things that you want to accomplish. For those of you that are interested in actually looking at those things, I think this is an innovation that has already happened in science, is this idea of looking at a system as a whole rather than its parts. I don't know, you know, how much it has caught up, but this is a positive way of thinking, but not only desiring, but positive acting towards that goal, even if we don't know what the goal is.
Louise?
Mine was just a quick note, actually, that resonated with me when Joseph was talking. And I do hope it won't be the end of this discussion, because I don't quote Machiavelli very often, and I would hate it to be the last thing you hear. But the idea that you should never waste the opportunities offered by a good crisis, I think, is a fairly positive way to go and look at this, because the world's been through some very difficult times, and there's more to go. But thinking about a better way of doing things, not for the sake of doing it, but because here is a problem that we can see tackling and there must be a better way, I think it's quite a nice way to think about social innovation. It's not a method for a method's sake. It's a method because people want to do the right thing, and people want to stop homelessness and want to stop climate change and want to provide properly for their aging populations. But just looking for that better way, I think, is a really nice way to think about what we're talking about here today.
And this is a systemic approach. So this is the call for a last round of comments or questions. Yes, please. Here's the microphone.
For the most needed eco-social inventions.
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments?
Can I just respond to that? Yeah. There's a think tank in Brussels called the Lisbon Council, that's what they're called, and they've just set up a network of eco-innovators who are doing really exciting things with new innovations in the world of eco. So have a look at that.
So, yes, please.
Hi, I came all the way from South America, Venezuela. And yeah, I must admit, my adaptive capacity was seriously challenged to Vienna's terrible weather because I didn't bring an umbrella and my scarf.
So is mine, actually.
I'd like to, since I'm a community service professor working with mainly slums in my country, I'd like to know, what are your opinions specifically regarding Ms. Lemo said? To come up with the most needed social innovations, one must ask the right questions. Due to the fact that this is taking place in a university, I'd like to know if the opinions or ideas of students have been taken into account, besides researchers and the system and professors. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I think yes, please. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Regarding social innovations, you were attributing issues like openness, networking, integration to social innovation. Is it true that the most innovative spheres are the technological and the economic sphere? And then is it true that social innovation is kind of like copying from these very innovative spheres? But my question is, isn't it also true that many people, we are always demanding more openness, more integration, more networking, but in fact we do have a lot of need for a kind of like a protection, for a kind of like conservative approach? So to which extent does social innovation also pay attention to such kind of needs as when, for example, in Switzerland right now, such result of the referendum of Swiss people voting against construction of mosques. So that is happening. It seems that people, especially in the social sphere, do need a lot of protection. And we did have in the 20th century social utopian ideologies and ideas, and I think we should have learned this lesson by being too idealistic, too utopian, not being sufficiently realistic. We just are losing people, and we do have fundamentalism and terrorism. So to which extent, what do you think, what means social innovation regarding what's going on in the world as well?
Thanks a lot.
I'll tackle that one in a second. I wanted to just go back to the slums in Venezuela and about asking people the question and getting their involvement. I won't talk about students and professors because I'm not a researcher. But one of the things that we're looking at in terms of one of the methods that we're rolling out in Australia is about human-centered design thinking. And I'd encourage you to read a great book by Tim Brown called Change by Design, because what he talks about is not only asking the right question, but asking the right people the right question. And actually going out and working with them to understand what their needs are before you then start coming up with crazy ways of trying to address them. And if you actually go to his website, he's the CEO of IDEO, which is a global design consultancy, which I think is just IDEO.com. They actually have a range of, they have a Spark Awards, which are design awards. And one of the winners of that award actually designed a field book that you could take out anywhere in the world. It was actually written it was basically done through symbols rather than through language, so it was a universal field book that you could actually give to villagers and actually have them work through and to help them design, work out what their own needs are as part of that first step, though whether that's possibly of use for you. But I think actually putting users, whether they be service users or the community, at the heart of what you're actually trying to do is a very, very fundamental part of social innovation. I guess that this, and trying to tie this to the second point, in terms of utopian ideals, I don't think anyone here has proposed that there's one single answer or one single vision of the future that is going to deliver all of this. There's going to be a lot of innovations across a lot of fields that will be driven by individuals who actually come up with ideas. While systemic reform is required, I don't think we actually have a single answer here about how this looks.
I'll talk about the university part and the student part then. You know, I think that is part of the co-production revolution that Hans was talking before. So certain universities are becoming much more hands-on. I teach in a professional school for the environment. So it's like a law school, a business school, but we form environmental workers. So one of the things that we do is actually we have something called a master's project. So rather than writing a thesis or a dissertation, I don't know, here is master's, it's always the opposite in the U.S., but you know, master's thesis in the U.S., you actually have a client, and that client can be somebody in Venezuela. I had, for instance, projects whose clients were in Bolivia, other clients that were in Mexico, and from that clientele, from that problem that is defined outside of the scope of the university, you create a project, and the students spend some time in Latin America, at least in my case, and that gives them some kind of hands-on eco-friendly solution, if you want to put it that as an innovation. It's not. I'm reluctant to say it's an innovation, but for sure it's an attempt to create a professional relationship that is predicated by demand rather than by supply. So it's the client who tells us what they need, and then you do it. And it can be in anything related to, including adaptation. So the one that I have in Bolivia right now, for instance, is about adaptation of water. So you try to understand what people need, but involving a larger community than just the scientific community.
Mm-hmm. Pierre.
Yes, I confirm that European Union is financing such, experimental governance, with a German team. We will see. But what we can say is that the model of sustainable development, the model of social innovation, the traditional economic model did not work. So that means that we have really to invent other things. So next year, you have this year of poverty. In World 2025, we had identified that 1.5 billion of people will live in slums in 2025. So that means it's really urgent. But for this, I am sure that we have not solved the situation, even with the new policy for social innovation. It's so wide issue that we are far from to be positive.
Mm-hmm. Louise, any comment?
No.
No. Okay. Hans Werner.
I think, as I said before, one of our aims in our institute is, and part of our vision, Leitbild, is that we want to strengthen the capacity of self-reflection of social agents in respective fields. I could say that in other words, basically it means to strengthen civil society against the necessity of needing protection. Of course it needs protection. And where minorities are minorities, they need protection. That's fairly clear. But we also need a strong will of open societies to integrate minorities. And that means also that working with minorities must lead them to be civil society, parts of civil society, and that means they must stop wanting to be only a separate minority, to become open too. And that links to the Swiss example. I'm very unhappy with that result of that referendum, but it shows that the lack of openness is a barrier to the strengthening of civil society, and it makes clear that there is a need of politics, of certain policies to intervene with that, because if not, conflict will be a closer of society and not an opener. So it's a true field of social innovation to find out how to strengthen civil society without exclusion processes, to strengthen civil society in order to be open for inclusion. And we have a number of that sort of processes even in our affluent societies. For example, in many countries we have the problem that a lot of people are excluded from the digital society, which is a clue to participate in society nowadays. People who do not have a PC are tendentially out of society, because you cannot even listen to the evening news without having a reference to some internet address. Just to put that on one point. The other point is, I have been talking, because that is one of our main concerns, about changing the way how to practice science. And of course, I also mean universities to
learn about how to be different universities. That includes something which is one of my main fields of work, which is working to create learning organizations mm-hmm. and creating management quality. Not quality management, although it has very much to do with each other, but working in favor of management quality. And that includes a stakeholder perspective in your own organization and asking, who is our customer? For universities, that's a very tricky thing, because it means, or it might mean at least, to restrict the autonomy of professors in order to meet the needs of students. That means professors have to come to terms in order to, for example, define what, which is, by the way, one of the positive, one of the positive things of the Bologna process. Professors have to come to terms to define something like a common curriculum, which is fairly new to many universities. And that's one of the positive things, to have an aim, to have a common objective, and to work together for this common objective. So that's something which might build some sense of responsibility. Of course, I do not want to offend any person in particular, but many professors, which I have come to know in my life, have very little sense of responsibility in terms of a collective, common, universitarian sense of responsibility. They have only the responsibility of their freedom of teaching. And that very often means to teach always the same every year, which is a very lazy way of earning money. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one point of starting to become a better science organization. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah, sure.
We should have made a link, an audio link to the auditorium maximum in this university, which is occupied by students since about 7 weeks now, and we want to do so until next year. So, okay. I would like to add one little thing that has not been said yet, and that relates to the endurance or sustainability of innovation. Brenton has said in the very beginning, social innovation is nothing new. Of course, collective agreements, trade unions, the traffic rules out there, everything we take for granted and makes our society working has been once a social innovation. And once a social innovation becomes successful, it becomes regular. So we need to work for social innovations in order to make them a regular way of living, of governance structures, be it in universities, be it in companies, in corporations, in nation states, or beyond. This is something that should be taken also into account when the discussion comes about why do we discuss social innovation. We're not discussing social innovation because it's a fancy thing and we just want to have it. It is there for a purpose, and the purpose is way beyond the notion of what it can carry on, because it's about measures, about rules, about playing the game newly, the game in many walks of life we encounter. This is something I wanted to add. Now, two more little questions, little answers to big questions, but involvement of students. From my side, I'll make it very short and rather precise, because we do not have had until now social innovation or even innovation in the curriculum, even for social scientists. And it's also not in the curriculum of engineers. but it happens. Yeah? So it was one of my thoughts when I started 20 years ago with this idea of Center for Social Innovation. It would be necessary as any other innovation policies, and it should become regular. And we are now maybe in the learning curve a little bit up. And what we can do from the Center for Social Innovation in that is, of course, I invited my students to come here. And we have had some discussions in the university. What I would like to establish here would be a PhD program for social innovation or social innovation-related fields. That would be a great achievement if we could do this at the university. So it's more plans than real facts until now. Not to neglect the students who came here. Thirdly, more action needed. This is a key phrase of the colleague here. As I said before, we cannot do everything. We do a lot. And I got the idea that I should not promise we engage in any kind of action, because as our center is financed project by project, somebody would have to pay us a project for getting involved into action. However, in all cases we are able to set up a project, be it for the famous territorial employment pacts in Austria. This is action, and we do research for them, we coordinate activities, and we accompany and monitor a lot of actions. We do so in Southeast Europe, and we started to do so in other regions of the world with EU-funded projects, networking projects. So there's lots of things going on, and so I come to my final words. We need documentation. We need to build strong alliances among us and beyond the institutions present here. And a little piece of documentation will be found on this website, on our website. This is already on. It simply says, www.zsi.at, social innovation. For the time being, there is only the information about this conference and this discussion, but we will open it, I'd say tomorrow, not tonight, for comments, and you are invited to comment. Everybody who has not had the word but would like to say something or got an idea afterwards, your comments are welcome, and we will work with them and presumably with many of you in the future.
So this was just the end of tonight's discussion, but the beginning of a broader process. More details here, as you can see on this webpage, listed. And with this, the very last things I want to say is thanks a lot for the guests at the podium. Long ways to come, but also short ways to come. And in any case, thanks for active participation and involvement, for your enthusiasm, which I think is particularly important if we want to drive things. And also thanks a lot for participating in this discussion and picking up on the opportunities that will come in the future. And with this, I want to wish you an continuation of this evening, if you like, with individual discussions. I think drinks and a little bit of food is still out there. Thank you very much.